session number 27226, reel 22.
Final hook, reel 22.
Okay. Well, that was on from Atty, which is a no-no as far as servicing is concerned and landing as an airfield, to El Janina, which was in Sudan, which is virtually English-occupied. If it wasn't, it was anglicised anyway. We had an airfield there, we had all the resources, we had a mess, and an RAF airfield. And that was a major landing strip for the reinforcement route. When you landed at Atty, that was not an airfield on the route, because all the RAF bypassed it. That's why they never saw anybody. It was never used, because they overflew. They had a mothership as well, so they probably if they're taking Sea Fires or Spitfires, I think they used later on. I think they used a Mosquito, but in the early days these Spitfires that were going across were flying behind a DC-3 or something quite slow. It must have been a pretty torturous exercise anyway. But anyway, we get to El Janina, which was 3 hours away, and we arrived there for the night. By that time, we were feeling a bit knackered, and we had sore bottoms. It was pretty bloody uncomfortable, I tell you. And one way to sew it is sort of wash your bottoms in alcohol. He said that'll harden up a little bit. So we all took our pants down, all washing it's everybody's bottom in whiskey. That was quite a bit of a laugh. And that was, we drew a blind over that because they just went to sleep, and that was it, and woke up the next day ready to go the next trip, getting back to civilization, which was El Janina to El Fasher. Now, the next few is Juba, Malakal, El Fasher, Obeid, are all standard aircraft, well organized. We had maps of them. And we knew where we were going, and there was no real problem there. It was just touch and go. Nothing I remember about one, except I think when we got to Soroti, which is past Juba Malakal, which was down through the Sud and into the airfield, to when we got to Soroti, the people, because it was a smaller airfield and the people didn't fly the we left the reinforcement route. We left it at Malakal, I think. Yes, we left it at Malakal because we then came down to Juba, where they didn't see airplanes very often. And when they heard an airplane, they all rushed to the airfield, all the bloody natives were miles around, and didn't stand around the airfield to look at it. They filled the airfield. And we had a hell of a job getting rid of all these people. We nearly killed them, and it was only the tail end. There were still people still wandering around the airfield when we landed, and we landed amongst them, and they ran away, then came back, and they thought the big day again. That was quite an interesting jolly. From there, we had to go from Soroti to Kisumu, which again, we're in home territory, really, we're in Kenya. And from then, we go to Kisumu, to Nairobi. Now, this is an experience that is very rare to anybody, and I don't know that. And the only people who would know about it and experience it were the people who flew in Kenya in the interwar years, and the Kenya people themselves were premier flyers. They were people who use aircraft for the obvious reason to get from A to B, because there weren't any roads. And they were flying all the aircraft, and everybody who had a farm had an aeroplane, under a Fleet Air Arm ex-pilot who was a thug, and he was involved in the very notorious case of the murder of Lord Errol, which is part and parcel of the story of Kenya. Going from Kisumu to Nairobi, you go from the level of the river over the escarpment into Nairobi, and life is quite ordinary. You know that the escarpment's 2,000 feet high, so you've got to fly at least 3,000 feet to miss it. So there's three aeroplanes going line astern, just quite happily looking, and I was running number three at that time. And we approached Nairobi towards the end of this escarpment. You appreciate what the escarpment is. And suddenly the aircraft in front didn't seem to be going over the edge of the escarpment. They were actually going lower and lower and lower and flying into the face of the escarpment. And when they saw what was happening, they turned round and flew back again. And then went up to about 5,000 feet and came back. Took a little bit of time. I had to get away from it. I saw what was happening, and I turned back straight away and went up to five grand. The other two got caught in this downdraft. Now, the downdraft himself is unique. If the wind was blowing from the southeast, I think it would be, over the escarpment, and at the top of the escarpment, because it's high, 3,000 feet, the air's colder. And down in the bottom of the valley, it's hotter. And the sun's shining, so the valley heat's going up. The wind's coming over, and it hits the edge of that escarpment. And I never saw the clouds. There were no clouds there. It was just an air mass you didn't see, coming over the top and going down the face of the escarpment, down to the lower level, hitting the hot spots down in the bottom of the valley, and going up to the top again. So there was a circle of air in that direction, with the wind coming over the top of the escarpment and blowing down, and then going down. And when you were flying in a soft, which was slow, it was only, we're doing probably 80 knots, hit a downflow with probably 15, 20 knots, probably. And you went into that, you were in the air mass, and you weren't flying across the mass, and it just took you down, and took you down. And I thought about that quite a lot afterwards. I thought, if it happened in England, in Scotland, there must have been a lot of people who found themselves in serious strife when a strong wind was blowing in a mountainous area, and when you were flying amongst mountains, and get into one of those downdrafts at 80 knots, you know, you're not no speed at all, no flying speed. So that was something, and I got back. Because I saw what I was doing, I got back about an hour and a half before they did. They had to go back again, and I don't think the bloke at the front realised what had happened, and it didn't go high enough, and he probably had another, I don't remember, but that was, again, a unique experience. So we're now into Nairobi, and that's not the end of the journey cycle by any means, because I arrived there about Christmas time. Where are we? We're December the 18th. We're at, set off for Nairobi, and we got there on the 18th, and we left there. I left there. Nairobi to Port Reitz. I got in. Silly me. We went to Nairobi. We stayed the night in the mess there at Nairobi. We had a meal the same day. That's right, we dropped in there, we got over the top, probably had a meal, and then we flew all the way back to Nairobi, which was another three and a half hours in the Saltfish. So we're now back at Port Reitz, and the next day, from some reason best known to themselves, it's the 19th, I went from Port Reitz to Nairobi. I was flying a paymaster lieutenant for some reason to Nairobi in a Fulmer, and I went there, dropped him down an hour, 1 hour 45 from Port Reitz to Nairobi in a Fulmer. So it's a fair old drag, you know. We've been doing 200, about 500 miles. So that, and then the day after that, I did an anti-submarine sweep on December the 20th in a Saltfish, after this Japanese submarine that was wandering around the place.
Yes, you explained about the submarine earlier on.
That's right.
Your activities with that.
And that became part of life, because that was a 4.5 hour. With hindsight, that the depth charges we were carrying would never have touched the outer shell of the submarine. It's quite something. Local flying to December, a bit of local bits and pieces. And then another anti-sub with three destroyers, Nizam, and for four hours and a bit, again trying to find the submarine. We didn't find it, but another Patron on the Christmas Eve, on the 24th, another 4 hours. Nothing spectacular there, except I did another one on Christmas Day, and that was a 4 hour job, and then that was really it, because I remember Christmas Day, the story of the pilot that flew around to take a captain back, didn't I? Have I told you that one already? Well, that was the day that happened. I mean, that was all this excitement with three anti-submarine patrols. They found when we were having our Christmas Day, this captain was supposed to go back, and the pilot flew around and landed back on the airfield, and that was Christmas Day done. Anyway, end of that problem. I then did a radar run in a Fulmer to see if they could pick anything up, but that was the end of December, and that panic for that submarine apparently subsided at that time. I'll just look at my thing. Kill it a minute, but just... the days go on now into January. A radar check, flying Hurricanes more than anything else. We were armed with Hurricanes with two depth charges on board, but never flew them. They were there. I told you about that one, didn't I, as well? So that's okay. We're going round, keeping ourselves in some sort of trim. We're flying the Fulmer test. All routines really. Night flying. Formation. Everything was quiescent, and we were just flying, just to keep ourselves in trim. January the 15th, Nairobi, Port Reitz, and Warris. I don't know why we did that, Jack and I did that. And I was flying a Hurricane most of that time. Warris, Augustin, nothing really exciting. We were just flying airplanes. I had an interesting thing on the 26th of January. We were quiescent then. There's not a lot going on. Mainly exercises for the fleet, if anything came in. No anti-submarines worth talking about. No big ones like that. Was a major exercise, and we never found the aircraft, the submarine. On the 31st of January, not sorry, I tell a fib, 26th of January, I was sitting in an Walrus with part of my ward on the runway going to go swimming. We were going to find a beach somewhere, and Jackie Plant, who was one of our pilots in the squadron, was doing a bombing exercise with real live bombs on the bombing range, which was in view of the airfield. And Jackie was flying at a fair old height, and he went into a dive, and he was in a vertical dive, and he just went straight in with his bombs and hit the water. And by the time they had come to the top, we were in the water with them, with the Walrus. And I was the only one that was really wounded. I took a chunk off my little toe. A little toe was hanging off in bits and pieces. That's nothing anyway. I'll tell you how that happened. But we saw him go in, and by the time the bubbles had subsided, we were there trying to get at them. We tried to get down, but it's too deep. We couldn't fly down. And they came up one at a time. Jackie Plant went straight into the water in a swordfish, and all he got was a massive great cut on the back of his leg and a headache, and that was all that happened to him. He came to the top, the, I don't know, one who was taking a couple of the boys for, on an exercise, and they were having a free flight, really. And another one of the blokes came to the top. Another one was drowned, unfortunately, Cameron, or Lamont, whom I knew were gunnery boys in Arbroath. I've got a photograph of him in my thing. We couldn't find him. They recovered his body the next day. But that was surprising, that a person can actually fly straight into the water, and just like that, full back. They're probably doing about 100 miles an hour. And two of them got out of it, and one, he was, he just didn't get out. His body was left in the aircraft, and, well, it wasn't left in, we found it later on. But we couldn't, if we'd have known what we know now about swimming and diving and flying, we would have been able to probably get at them, because we could have got down with a weight, if we had a spare weight on the aircraft, and just jumped over the side, take a deep breath, and we'd go down. But we couldn't swim down, it was just impossible. It was, I don't know how deep it was actually, but it was probably about 30 foot, something like that. It was deep enough anyway to drown somebody. Anyway, so that was a nasty.
What happened to your toe?
Pardon?
What happened to your toe?
Oh, well, we were. yeah, when we were, in the aircraft, we were in the, on the walrus, and I was on the front of the walrus, trying to lean over to pull, I think, Cameron out. And I put my foot through the glass windscreen of the thing. And there was I with a little toe. I got something that was, I got something that I've never heard anybody mention at all. Officially, I was wounded. I got a wound stripe. Have you ever heard of them? I don't know what they were like or anything like that. But that was a stupid thing. It's stitched it back on that little toe. But interesting thing about that too. We were in. We lived in huts, of course, and we had all sorts of bugs and beetles around, and snakes and things like that. And one day, I stubbed my toe against the bed or something like that, and a little thing like a piece of frog spawn came out of that toe that I've just been telling you about that I cut. And it left an indentation about the size of my thumb in my toe where the skin was. But it hadn't broke the skin at all, nothing at all. And I picked it up, and it was just like a piece of frog spawn without a black blob in the centre of it. And I was interested in it, so I took it out and put it in a cigarette tin and put it on a shelf or something in my cabin to go and see the doc, to have a look at it, see what it was, natural curiosity. When I got back, there it wasn't. It had gone, and I often wondered what it was. But I also had a pal who got one of these things, the jiggers, in his chest with all the bits and pieces. And when that broke, all the that was nasty. There were a lot of nasties around, but they didn't, you know, we seemed to protect ourselves from them somehow or other. Anyway, but that's all part and parcel of Mombasa. So, nothing nasty there. I did, very interesting. Another exercise too, which is in the same time scale. We're talking about January the 26th, the 1st of February. I went up with what do they call him? Norris, a Canadian called Norris, in a hurricane. We went up to about 18,000 feet. 15,000 or 16,000 feet anyway. Just see what it was like upstairs. And he coming back, we were flying one behind, and I was flying on quite cheerfully. When I got back, he wasn't there. He'd gone straight in. And he'd gone in, and he'd broken the strap and broke both his ankles. And he went out in his dinghy, and he was picked up by a native fisherman. And Jack Dyson went out here, and Jack's not down on here, but Jack Dyson went out in the Swordfish later, next day. And he was still there in this, found that little fishing boat, when they waved to him and went round and picked him up in the in his walrus, and he had two broken ankles. Big lad he was too, big as you. He was, he must have weighed 15 stone, I think. And he just, it was from low, we were too low on the water, obviously didn't see where he was, and probably, well, I didn't know where he was anyway, and I lost him completely. When I got back, he wasn't there. Interesting game. So we went down, there's nothing else, so he went swimming, One interesting exercise there, we took, we went down to Tanga in a, took the walrus and the saltfish, ice fly and the saltfish, with three members of the ENSA party to go and entertain the people down in Tanga. Well, they were old and bold, well past the sell-by date. They were all pissed out of their minds from the day they went there. And they, I saw one of the one in ten rooms, I wouldn't want to go again. That was so, but we did that sort of thing. And we at that time, we were only, when we were free, we had various things to do. But we, the afternoons, if we flew in the morning, the rest of the day was free, so we go swimming. And we had the old walrus and anything else. We'd just pile into the walrus and go flying down, find a base on the beach, land on the beach, go swimming, get come back again. Quite an exotic lifestyle. We enjoyed it. But it wasn't too hazardous, really. Just the general flying, the things that happen when you're flying. One of the exercises there in the book was... I don't know if it's age it was at. Let's see. It's somewhere around here because when we were flying, we also did drogue toes for when things are quiet. We later on from February, we're doing a lot of work for the ships. And two things had happened. When you put a drogue out for towing with a for the big ships, it's a long tow. A big one, 5,000 feet of it, wire, and that's a lot of wire. And if the tow breaks or the drogue comes off, you can pull the wire in. And the wire is operated by a windmill on, so it sticks outside the aircraft. I don't know which aircraft it was. I think we had a Sawfish with one, and we had a Defiant as well, which is a bit faster. And we used to use a Sawfish for the army. And this time, this was at Port Rees. Two things happened, and I think they were both they're both the same incident. I'll tell you this. I'll tell you the story anyway. Both the same incident when the drogue didn't come off. That was it, yes. It was the same incident. The windmill was a wooden windmill that operated outside the aircraft to wind the drum to bring the 5,000 feet of wire in. And the AG was bringing it back so he could get it back inside and cut it off with his cutter, and that would be the end of the job. And the blade blew off. took his finger off, so he was bleeding like a stuck pig. And I, the first I knew of it, he touched me on the back of the head and took his finger off. And the finger was blood all over the place. And so I rang up home and said, well, we've got a problem because I have some feet of wire out here with a drogue on the back of it. And there's no way. So we've now got this aircraft with a piece of string with a drogue on the end of it. We've got to get rid of something. And the first thing we did was had to go low. So we dropped down to the ground, and until the drogue hit the ground and caught into a tree and broke the wire, or whatever it did. We didn't have a drogue on the end anyway. And we're still faced with the problem of coming back to an airfield with 5,000 feet of wire behind us. And a bit of a problem. And we solved it, strangely enough, and rather smartly, I thought, that we had to be very careful. We're flying over an airfield with people around and everything else. And we flew on the outskirts of the airfield after we'd got rid of the drogue in a tight circle, going round and round and round, and getting closer to the airfield until we got where the airfield was. We were dragging a curl of a cable round and back to the airfield, and then we got into the air circuit still with this cable at the back, because he tried to cut it with his cutters, but he couldn't, and he lost the cutters through the hole in the bottom of the aircraft as well, so he couldn't cut the cable. That was the problem, and I forgot to mention that in the early stages. And so we had this cable, and we did a circuit round the airfield, and then we started doing tight turns all the way around over the airfield, and then had to straighten it all out so it could come in and land with a tight landing, almost across the piece of cable that we put down, and landed on the airfield and got away with it. It didn't kill anybody or anything. But it's silly little things like that that are quite unusual, you know, and it doesn't happen to everybody. But you can imagine, it's not 5,000 feet of cable with a drogue on the back, taking a lot of stress. It wasn't, you know, it had a fairly heavy pair of wire cutters to cut it. Anyway, so that's that one. Now, let's stop there for a minute, because I've got... life got a bit better and quieter, because the war seemed to be moving... further away, and it appeared this later on, but one or two incidents that take me personally away from Port Reitz. Now, a normal tour of duty in the Navy is 6 months if you go deep tropical in West Africa. We didn't go home then. We then found ourselves in Nairobi, and I've been away then for well over a year. We're talking about 1944, beginning of 44, end of 43. So I'd been away for more than my share of time. Life was quieter. We used to go ashore, and one particular night, and I don't drink, I don't bother at all, and so I used to have other social activities. The boys used to go into the club. We had a 20-100-way desert buggy. All the pilots went into the club and they had the night out. And I went to the pictures, actually, and with a nurse, Oblinsky, called Oblinsky, who was actually the cousin of Serge Oblinsky, who was a big rugby player in Roslyn Park. And there's a story about that, and my own son and Roslyn Park and everything else. But that's by the way. And we were quite good friends. And we went together, actually, all the way back to Ceylon later on. That's another part of the story. But we'll get to that in a minute, because we're now having free time. The boys have gone ashore. I've gone to the pictures. I've gone back to the truck. And there was Shorty Curran, who was one of my buddies from West Africa days, and Jack Dyson. Shorty sitting in the driving seat, Jack Dyson sitting in the other seat, and I'm there with eight other pilots and observers from the squadron. We all got into the back to go home. Now, Port Reitz is an island joined to the mainland by a big, not a bridge, causeway. A bund, a causeway. On causeway, on one side is the water and the places where they chuck all the rubbish, including a lot of lime kilns and lime pits. And it's on a curve. And Shorty is sitting in the car, and I say, all right, Shorty, oh, it's all right. And we set off to come back home to the base, which is away from Mombasa itself. And Shorty was driving along, not too well, but he was driving along with the whole of the squadron in the back. And we got to this causeway, which has got a curve on it. And he was moving across the road a little bit of the curve. He went... And suddenly a big American car came by, with his lights flashing, peeping his horn and everything else. And, of course, they were in a stage of merriment at that time. And Jack Dyson stuck his face out of the door, and here's the English language. As this car went by, I said, who the fuck the hell do you think you are? Father fucking Christmas. And this car went on its merry way. And about 15 seconds later, Shorty Curran hadn't followed the road at all. He'd gone straight across. We took down about 100 yards of concrete pillars with the fencing over the top, and gone down the embankment, which was be 30, 40 foot high. Got photographs in there. You've maybe seen them. Anyway, strangely enough, he was in such a state that he didn't try to get back onto the road. He just let it go down the hill, which was rather good. He went down to the bottom of the hill, when it got to the bottom, they sort of got some sense at all, and it did a sharp left and came to a grinding halt. All wheels, all standing up, nobody rolled over, nothing at all. And that's the whole of the flying fleet air arm in Mombasa at risk. And I said to the boys, I was unlucky, I was a senior there by a seniority more than anything else. I said, don't anybody get out on the other side because there's water there. All right? It's near the end.